Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. I have two very special guests with us today. Kind of a blast from the past and some up-and-coming exciting stuff for the future. I'm joined today by Colin Miller and Rabia Chowdhury. How are you guys doing?
Great. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, doing well. Good to see you.
Yeah, Colin and I were just talking before we started the show. I was getting ready to grade exams for the college, so certainly an exciting time of year for you.
Yeah, I have a bunch of evidence exams to go through, which we're seeing kind of play out in real time in New York with the trial, all the evidence issues that are coming up, which is interesting.
So are you now, prior, like back when Undisclosed first started, you weren't working in the Innocence Clinic then, right? You were teaching other law classes, or were you working as part of an Innocence Clinic at that point?
Same as now. I teach evidence, criminal law, criminal adjudication. We're just starting this Wrongful Convictions Club here at South Carolina, where we're going to have students working on wrongful conviction cases, which is going to be great.
Oh, that's exciting.
You should invite Adnan to come down and speak to the class whenever it's up and going.
Yeah.
I could have Adnan come to Michigan too, because I just interviewed. Did either you guys listen to or hear about the Murder 101 podcast? It was high school teacher in Tennessee, investigated a cold case and ended up solving a series of
what?
Yeah.
No. Oh, with her students?
With the students, with high school students. Yeah.
That's amazing. It's called Murder 101.
Yeah. So they didn't make a podcast. They were actually a sociology class. They did the work, and then iHeartMedia came in and did a podcast about it, and they're on it. And Alex is the teacher there.
Amazing.
Which is pretty crazy. And I'm teaching broadcast journalism at our local high school. And next year we just got some flexibility to add some advanced classes in. So after nice. Picking his brain, we're going to be teaching an investigative journalism class next year, where my students are going to start investigating a wrongful conviction.
I love nice. That. I'm the only one who's not teaching. I feel very deprived, this FOMO.
Yeah. What are you doing? What are you doing with your life?
What am I doing with my life? I'm wasting away. That's what I'm doing.
So how long has it been since Undisclosed? You guys, turns out took a hiatus. It hasn't been 2 years. It's been a year. How long has it been?
No. Has it been two or three, Colin?
Little over 2 years. I think we ended early 2022.
Yeah, it's been a couple of years.
Yeah, so I remember talking to Rabia when you guys shut it down. There's just, life is happening. Everybody's busy doing their own things. I didn't know it was coming back, and then I just Rabia shared with me, it was maybe a month ago, that you and Colin are coming back with Undisclosed. So first of all, I want to hear about that. When are you guys coming back? What's the plan? And how did it come about that you're going to relaunch Undisclosed?
I think Colin and I always planned to come back in some fashion, but this was like a time when it was like my dad was really ill. There's so much happening in our personal lives. And for me, definitely. And I think Colin had some stuff going on too. We just needed to step aside. And Undisclosed was, Bob, if of all the podcasts, yours is probably closest to ours in that it goes year round.
Right.
And it's investigative. It's just exhausting, right? It's scripted. You have audio clips. You have to interview people. It was so much. We really needed to just take a little bit of break. And I definitely needed the time because, my dad was dying and I needed time to be with him. And I had a book coming out. And so we always had it. It was just I think every 6 months I'd be like, hey, Colin, what's up?
How are we doing? Right.
And yeah, I would text him. And I think now I just felt like the right time.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're targeting either later this year or early next year to have it kick back here.
Yeah.
Have you guys selected a case yet?
Colin had a great idea how to open the relaunch, right, Colin? Why don't you share that first?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously we are awaiting Adnan's ruling from the Supreme Court of Maryland, right? Mm-hmm. So that is going to be coming down the pipes, hopefully within the next month. And so we obviously want to have something on that to sort of restart things. And then kind of looking back, we have all this material from Adnan's case that we haven't covered and talked about.
Colin, it's time for the bombshell. People are going to lynch you at this point because they're like, we have been waiting 7 years for the bombshell. So yeah, we have stuff. And I'm going to make Colin divulge the bombshell.
Yeah. When Rabia, you came on to talk about, or we were on your Instagram live to talk about reply brief. I think the comment section was full of everybody going, Colin's bombshell, Colin's bombshell, Colin's bombshell.
I gotta leave that to Colin, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there's a lot of stuff that we want to talk about, that, you know, didn't quite make it to our, I mean, look, that was our first case, you know, the coverage was from a very long time ago. So clearly, obviously a lot's happened since then. So.
Yeah. And then I have a case I'm finalizing now, kind of a deep dive wrongful conviction case, person wrongfully convicted for decades. And so I'm going through doing the background research, getting everything together. There's new expert material, witnesses to talk to, alibi, eyewitness issues. So it'll be a deep dive case that we think will have a good chance of leading to an exoneration.
That's awesome. And so I take it between now and when you launch, that's when you're going to be gathering all that intel and doing the interviews. Are you guys going to be out doing like some of that field work yourself, or do you have PIs do that kind of work?
In the past, we've done it ourselves. Susan and I are the ones who've done it. And I brought on like Sarah Kalin to work with me sometimes and, you know, different folks, but depending on availability. But yeah, I told Colin, I'll do the field work. You do the file work. Yeah. That's how we would have to like divide and conquer. And then he's got, you know, a whole army of students as well, law students at his disposal, which is really helpful. But the plan is that, yeah, if we need boots on the ground, then I'd definitely be down there.
I'm so excited. So when you relaunch, you're going to start off kind of buttoning up all these loose ends with Adnan's case and then move into another wrongful conviction case. Do you intend on Undisclosed continuing to run year round, or are you going to try to do seasons and break and seasons and break?
We're being ambitious. Colin wants to go full front throttle. I mean, yeah. I mean, tell him the plan, Colin.
Yeah, I mean, the plan is to have basically two deep dive wrongful conviction cases per year with about 10 episodes each. So that would be 20 total episodes. And then the rest of the year, have some combination of, you know, one or two episode short series about cases. So might have seen in the news the C.J. Rice case out of Philadelphia, yeah, which is an exoneration, Jake Tapper and all that. So that was a case that my students and I worked on and contributed to. And so that might be, if we were running at the time, two or three episodes covering that. Speaking to people about their, sort of what you do.
Talk show episodes, yeah.
Sort of talk show format of, here's legislation about compensation for exonerees, or here is new legislation dealing with eyewitness identification, sort of letting people know about developments in the wrongful conviction space.
Yeah, and that's, and I was just thinking when you guys are coming back into it, I'm so excited for you to come back, but working in the space and doing like you guys were doing before the year round, it almost feels like a good analogy. I know Colin loves a good analogy. For me, is like I have a friend who had a couple kids, and the youngest of the two was 18. Actually, Robbie fits in this category too. And then having another baby when that one's almost it's like you just start to feel that relief, and then there's got to be some anxiety coming back into, because for me it's that constant and people don't realize that when you're doing the work that you guys do and we do, that constant two episode a week deadline every week that just every time you think you're done, it stacks up again the next week.
I mean, the time goes so quickly. I mean, like I have a show right now that's called Nighty Night, right? All I do is narrate already written stories, like stories that are like, you know, old kind of creepy horror stories. Uh-huh. And I'm like, how hard can this be? You know, I record one story a week, takes me a couple hours. But before I know it, I'm like, wait a minute, the week just went by and I owe the editor another story. It happens so quickly. But I feel like, Bob, your format is more anxiety riddled because you're doing investigative stuff in real time. Ours is done. We do a lot of our, I think most of our, you know, writing and investigation and research is done beforehand, before we start scripting and recording. There might be developments as we go along, or, you know, as listeners listen, we might get some new information. But yours is like literally happening in real time.
Yeah.
And that is much more stressful. Like for me, when I, you know, when I do my season, I have the episodes like laid out. I know what we're going to talk about, you know, the case, we're done with the case, you know, reviewing the case file. We're still way ahead, but I'm hoping that we tighten up the format a little bit. You know, Undisclosed used to be like, I admire the listeners so much because their attention span was like Herculean, because most people after like 35, 40 minutes tap out, but we'd go for like an hour and a half
Yeah.
Like 15,000 word scripts, right? So I feel like if we tighten it up a little bit, it'll be an easier lift on us too. And we also hopefully want to do like a YouTube channel at the same time. So that could be fun. And, you know, I don't, Colin, do you still want to do an addendum type of second episode a week? I don't know if we can handle that.
I mean, it's interesting because it always feels like there's something more, right?
Oh, there's always more. There's always more, yeah.
Well, and you get feedback from listeners and stuff after the episode drops.
Yeah. Or we could do it on a Patreon, which we had a Patreon for Undisclosed, but we put nothing on it because we wanted everything to be public. So we never used it. We just set it up, never used it. So this might be the time that we actually utilize Patreon.
Yeah. And that's the challenge doing the work we do, where we want the audience engagement. We all have lots of friends in the true crime space that are doing, you know, great with their Patreon, but, you know, they've got so much exclusive content behind Patreon. But for us, I want everybody to hear the evidence, yeah. You know, we use ours for things like this. Like, we have right now 65, 63. People that are watching, like our patrons, get to watch stuff early and get it live, but everybody still has to get all of the information. But I always like Colin's idea is kind of what I'm trying to kind of ease truth and justice into, is we've cut back on some staffing and stuff too, to where try and take breaks between the big seasons where we're doing interviews and catch ups. And you guys too, you have so many cases. There's always, you know, like this past week, we just had a huge ruling in the West Memphis 3 case. So,
you know. So happy for, I mean, Bob, I know how close and invested you are. So happy for Damien.
Yeah.
And of course, yeah, I mean, right. Same. It was funny because you had, I think it was maybe the day before the West Memphis 3, where now there's going to be DNA testing. And then I think the day afterwards, the state in the Jason Carroll case.
Yes.
One of our last cases, dropping their opposition to DNA testing. And now it's like two separate boxes of evidence that they've found, including the blood under Sharon Johnson, the victim's nails. And so, yeah, I mean, both of those cases should
be
really.
I'm calling it. It's the husband. Anyway, the Jason Carroll case, it was so frustrating because, you know, for years it was the same, like, oh, there's no evidence to test. And lo and behold, they found two boxes of evidence. After Undisclosed aired, you know, the attorneys continued to work. And then it was season two of Bear Brook. They covered it as well. And so Jason Moon, I think, was actually there when they discovered one of the boxes. But the fact that New Hampshire, the attorney general's office, they have been opposing the DNA testing, and suddenly they just drop opposition. That's a big deal. So I think that DNA testing is going to happen soon. Greg Lance's DNA testing is happening July 2nd and 3rd, and I will be down in Cookeville, Tennessee for that. And I'm excited about that. So I'm like, you know, I just feel like we're going to see a bunch of progress in these cases that mean so much to us this year.
Well, feels like there's so many ebbs and flows in this space, where it's like there, you know, a year ago, it just felt like at least for us in a lot of our cases, everything was just one bummer after another. You know, we just recently, our season 7 case last month, Jamie Snow, you know, he was just denied DNA testing, you know, so it's just like everything's down and we're still fighting. We're going to be appealing that. But then it's like all of a sudden, all at once, Jason Carroll, Damien Echols, like all the Greg Lance, all these like DNA testings are getting approved. And so it's exciting to know that we may actually find real answers to these cases after all these years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people have asked me over the years, like, you know, I'm so proud of the work of Undisclosed. I mean, I'm more proud of it than anything I've ever done. And not just Adnan's case, but all the work. And I learned so much from Susan and Colin, because this is not work I knew how to do. And people are like, you know, what's the secret to getting people out? And I was like, to me, other than the fact that obviously you need to reinvestigate everything, is just keeping at it, like keeping just not walking away. The next appeal. Okay, that appeal, like you. Just the persistence is what finally does it. I just feel like if you keep pushing on the door, like for 10 years, 15, 20, eventually things give way. People change. People in administrations change. DAs change. Laws change. You know what I mean? Forensic science changes. But there has to be like one person who just keeps at it. And that's, and with Jamie Snow, with others, you know, where they're stuck. I mean, for me, I think one of those miraculous cases, I think, of all the ones we've done, is Joey.
Joey Watkins?
Joey Watkins, thank you. Joey Watkins, where when it came to Susan, you know, they were like, we have nowhere to go here. It just seemed like the most hopeless case ever. but it was a worthy case to look at, and he's home. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's just, you just need somebody to keep working at it.
Well, it's amazing to see how much sometimes just pressure has an effect on things. Yeah. You know? Like I know for in the West Memphis 3 case, that was, you know, there was no possibility of any DNA testing for years. And then, you know, when not so much from my podcast, but when the docuseries came out, you know, all of a sudden now you had millions and millions of people that were watching it. And I mean, I've seen the emails from the prosecutor to Damien's defense that said, fine, we'll do the DNA testing. If you have him call off those, I think he called me an asshole or something along those lines.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, has him call off. Because, I mean, we had you know, tens of thousands of people calling and writing and emailing and everything. And it just, it finally gets the wheels turning again.
Well, I was trying to figure out what happened in New Hampshire with Jason Carroll. Like, how come, you know, they've been opposing it for 17 months. They've been opposing DNA testing and suddenly they gave in. And my understanding, you know, New Hampshire is a tiny little legal community.
Yeah.
And all the entire community's got their eyes on this case because it is it's gotten so much coverage, but also it would potentially be the first exoneration in the state using DNA testing. And my understanding is it was eventually just pressure from the legal community that was felt in the attorney general's office. And they're like, you know what, we're looking like real holes here by not just allowing for it. You know what I mean? So just fighting the DNA testing is never a good look.
Yeah. And well, and my hope is that the work that us and so many others in the space are doing is kind of creating that trend, you know, where people are finally like, I have to believe prosecutors, attorney generals in places, you know, and people in these positions around the country at this point are seeing the constant backlash against the people that are fighting against DNA testing. Because in that case, in many of the cases we're doing, you know, Damien didn't file to have his conviction overturned. He wasn't asking for that. He's asking to test evidence so we can have more information. Then let's figure out where to go next. Like to fight the idea of getting more data in the cases, and especially in particular that case where, you know, we've agreed to fund it. It's not going to cost him anything. Like,
right.
To fight that.
There's no reasonable explanation other than you don't want to know the truth. That's it.
Right.
Eat stress-free this spring with delicious, convenient, ready-to-eat meals from Factor. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. So what are you waiting for? Get started today and fuel up for those springtime goals. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals so you can get back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. Factor meals are all about no fuss and no mess. They eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning up. Simply heat and savor the good stuff. And with Factor, you can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Pause or reschedule deliveries to suit your lifestyle. Factor is your solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Factor meals have been a lifesaver for me this spring. It's Bella's senior year of softball, and I'm determined not to miss a single game, which means at least 2 days a week, I'm scrambling to throw a meal together before I head to the ball field. Factor saves the day every time. And also, Factor is celebrating Earth Day all month long. Look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for their lowest carbon footprint meals. Head to factormeals.com/truth50 and use code truth50 to get 50% off of your first box plus 20% off of your next box. That's code truth50 at factormeals.com/truth50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. Nothing complements a great meal like a nice glass of wine. But have you ever walked into a store, stared at a giant wall of wines, and had absolutely no clue which bottle to get? Yep, me too, all the time. So I just don't do it anymore. Instead, I've been getting my wine from our new sponsor. Today's episode is sponsored by Naked Wines. No more looking like an idiot at the store. Naked Wines is a subscription service that seamlessly connects you to the finest independent winemakers on the planet. So you get a box of the market's best quality wines, however often you'd like, for just a fraction of the price you'd pay in stores. And if you use my code TRUTH for the code and the password at nakedwines.com, you get their incredible deal of 6 bottles for just $39.99. Look, that's under $7 a bottle. And we're not talking Boone's Farm here. Becky and I just had an amazing bottle of Pinot Noir the other night from Naked Wines, and it was one of the best Pinots we've ever had. Like, I'd expect to pay like $15 a glass for this wine. But it came in our $39.99 box of 6 bottles from Naked Wines. It's pretty awesome. It's like having 21-year-old money and 45-year-old taste. I really don't know how they do it. Naked Wines connects winemakers and wine drinkers directly, allowing for vineyard-to-door delivery at up to 60% off what you would pay in the store. They cut out the retail middleman costs, and the winemakers pass those savings on hundreds of top-quality, award-winning wines on to you. Naked Wines has no commitments and no membership fees. You can join them hassle-free, and you can pause or cancel at any time. So head to nakedwines.com/truth and click enter voucher in the top right and put in truth for both the code and password to get 6 bottles of wine for just $39.99 with shipping included. That's $100 off and less than $7 per bottle. That's nakedwines.com/truth and use the code and password truth and grab 6 bottles for just $39.99. One last time, that's nakedwines.com/truth, code and password truth for $100 off your first 6 bottles.
In the Greg Lance case, you know, the prosecutor has been fighting DNA testing, and this is a little county, you know, Putnam County. It's not a huge, I mean, it's not that it's a little county, but it's the kind of county where in any given election, in a county level election, it might be a matter of 150 votes that could, like, you know what I mean? Like swing the election, or 50 votes.
Yeah.
Like a very, and I was like, that'll be the next step to the family. I was like, if he keeps fighting this and we can't get this, we need a new DA. And I will come down there myself and buy those billboards, and we will get this guy voted out. We will, all you have to do is go house to house and explain to people what's happening. People will be outraged if they really know what's happening here. That this person, like, I mean, so, you know, you gotta try everything. And, but anyhow, there's a hearing this summer, so hopefully we won't have to get to that point.
Nice. Do you know, was there in the Jason Carroll case, was there a change in the guard or anything in the AG's office, or just, they just changed their mind?
No, they just changed their mind. That's what we know. Yeah. I mean, they have a little caveat in their motion saying, you know, of course we reserve the right to analyze the results in our own way and blah, blah, blah. And obviously that's going to happen. I mean, and I fully expect, like so many prosecutors, if his DNA doesn't show up anywhere, they're going to be like, that doesn't mean he didn't do it. We hear this over and over again. But, you know, hopefully there will be some affirmative DNA. I mean, my bet's on the husband's DNA all underneath her fingernails and on the knife and all that stuff. So let's see.
Yeah, and that's going to be, if we get the testing through. Luckily, in the West Memphis 3 case, we do have a new guard there. Like, since the prosecutor that was opposing the testing is now out, and there's a new prosecutor in, and she is, she's younger. She's not, as far as we know, connected to kind of the old guard in that county. So we're really hoping that, you know, we'll get some positive movement forward in this. And hopefully she'll just join in the motion and continue, because happened was the Supreme Court of Arkansas remanded, you know, they reversed the decision. Essentially, we just had a whole episode on this, so I don't want to bore my listeners with all of it, but they, you know, they had the original trial court judge when we took the motion to her, and it was a whole horse and pony show. You know, we had paid for experts, we had all this, we had people travel from all over, literally the world. There's people flew in from Europe to go to be there to support at this hearing. They had this whole show there where they wouldn't let us in the building. They claimed COVID protocols that the cop there told us, like, well, they haven't used COVID protocols in a year and a half, but they told us we couldn't go inside. Then they did. It was 100 degrees outside. They told anybody outside that if they got in their car, they had to leave. They had to stand outside in the heat if they wanted to stay there. And then they walked in only for her to say, you know, something that could have been a summary judgment. She
right.
Yeah. For her to say that, well, since he's not in custody, habeas doesn't apply. So they, you know, she punted it away. And now the Supreme Court has remanded that back. So now we're going to either go back and actually litigate the merits, or hopefully
just join the motion.
Hopefully the new DA will just join the motion and we can move forward there. But then it comes down to, what if, you know, not saying this is the case, but let's say we find out that, you know, Terry Hobbs, you know, there was already the issue with one of the hair consistent with him was in one of the knots. Yep. But if we find his skin cells all over those knots, is the DA going to try to make the argument, well, he was the stepfather of one of the victims?
Right.
Or are they going to look at the, you know.
Yeah, but his hair was in the knot of not his son's stepson. It was like another one of the other victims. I mean, that makes no sense to me. And
even more so than that, as I've made the argument over and over again, like they're saying it could be transfer. Those shoelaces were on the boy's shoes. Then they were untied, pulled through,
and retied,
pulled through every one of those eyelets to get out of the shoe, and then retied in the hair they found. And we don't know that it was Hobbs. It was, but it's consistent with his, because it was mitochondrial DNA, I think is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah.
But it was tied into the new knot.
Yeah.
So the idea of it being transferred, just while not impossible, seems highly unlikely to me.
Yeah, that would have been a very sticky hair to stick to that shoelace throughout that entire process. Can I address something somebody's saying in the chat? By the way, I can see all your comments and hi to everybody, but I cannot chat for some reason, but that's fine. Can I just respond to something Valeria said?
Yeah.
Am I saying that name right? It's saying that the problem with the husband's DNA is that he was her husband, so the argument doesn't prove or disprove anything. I think she's talking about... she's talking about Jason Carroll. Well, if she's got her husband's blood under her fingernails, like, I should not have my husband's blood under my fingernails. Like, that's because she certainly fought off her attacker. We know she had the kind of injuries you could tell consistent with that. So if she had her husband's blood under her fingernails, I think that tells us a different story. And if obviously there's any of his touch of DNA on the actual knife itself, I mean, then it's, you know, and nothing's there for Jason. I think it tells a different story.
Yeah. And also in the chat for Colin, Jennifer Lopez says DNA denied twice in the John Brookins case. Colin, I personally can't wait until you can finally report on John's case again. All the truth will come out. I'm not familiar with that case. Which one is that?
Yeah. So John Brookins was convicted of the murder of Sharon Ginsburg, and the claim, which is supported by tons of evidence and witnesses, is that the daughter is the one who fatally stabbed her mother with a pair of scissors. And the state has vociferously fought DNA testing. There was this hearing with John Fetterman, who was sort of the head of the board determining whether testing should be done, and that testing was not approved. And there are developments. In fact, I just got an email earlier this week asking for some materials. So there is a team working on John Brookins' case. But yeah, they're fighting the DNA testing because they, I think, are very scared it is going to be the daughter's DNA that turns up on the murder web.
And that's like what you just said is what drives me crazy about some of these prosecutors. Like they're worried that they might find the actual killer's DNA and have to let the innocent guy go, like that. And that seems like the attitude in so many of these cases. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, Colin, while I have you on here, how you're feeling and what we can expect with Adnan's case and the ruling that we're waiting for from the Supreme Court of Maryland.
Yeah, I mean, looking at when decisions are usually issued, we would have expected this opinion to have already been issued. Uh-huh. That could mean a few things. This is a case of first impression that has not been ruled upon before, and it's going to let future litigants know what the rules are. And so on the one hand, you could say the Supreme Court of Maryland is very carefully crafting an opinion, and it's taking a while to do so. Another possibility is we have a deeply divided court where we're going to have a majority opinion and a dissenting opinion. I'm still expecting that within the next month or so. It's tough to read the tea leaves, but yeah, I would expect by the end of May, certainly we should have an opinion.
Yeah. And again, there's parallels here to what we just saw in Damien, in the West Memphis 3 ruling, in that, you know, it, from the Supreme Court of Arkansas, that one set legal precedent. I mean, it's to a very niche part of the law, but that was, you know, it, we were dealing with an interpretation of, you know, the, so there was within the habeas statute in Arkansas, it allowed for DNA testing. There was a clause in there that said, you know, during habeas, or if you're claiming actual innocence, the original judge interpreted that as, well, since it falls under habeas, if they're not in custody, they can't do it. Yeah. And now the Supreme Court of Arkansas has ruled that, no, that's not what that means. Being in custody is not a precursor for you to be allowed to do DNA testing. So it's now, that order now sets the law of the land in Arkansas. Is that, that's similar to what we're dealing with? Because what we're dealing with is, it all revolves around victims' rights, right? Or the victims' families' rights, that, that they're claiming that everything should be null and void because Hayes' brother wasn't given enough time to be in court.
Yeah.
I mean, there's also a claim that the victim and their family should be able to either address the court or present evidence. And there was even an argument about when they're in camera and the judge's chambers reviewing the evidence, they should be there. So there's a whole gamut of where they're balancing the defendant's rights versus the victim.
The victim's family is arguing that they should be able to literally present evidence at this hearing, you know, in which that like as if they're the state. And I don't think I've seen that ever anywhere. But there's also the question of, I mean, and I don't, the problem is like it hasn't been raised directly at all, I think. But the fact for me, one of the most troubling things about this entire series of events, I mean, I'm like, fine, you know what? Give them another hearing. Give them 2 months to come out to the hearing. I mean, like, you know what? I went to every single hearing in 24 years, except for the one that that man kept me out of, Thiru Vignaraja. And the family never came once. Okay, fine. But they got to address the court through via Zoom. We all, you know, we had to recess. We had to wait for her brother to get on the Zoom. He got on the Zoom. He had to say, the intermediate appellate court was like, number one, the victim's family has a right to be present, so they need more notice, but they don't have a right to speak, which is a really weird ruling. Like, why would they just want to like be there and say nothing? But the second thing is they reinstated the charges. And I think that is like one of the most deeply troubling things to me, because shouldn't that be beyond the power of the court? Only a prosecuting office should be able to bring charges. Since when can courts reinstate charges that have been dropped by the DA? That's the part that really, I'm like, what kind of precedent does that set for exonerees? I mean, imagine we all know the fight, the kind of fight it takes to get a DA to drop charges against somebody who, you know, who's maintained their innocence. And then a court can reinstate them without any due process, without an indictment, without like anything. That blows my mind.
Yeah. Colin, what are your thoughts on the filing in general? The arguments that are being made, do you think they hold water? Have you seen that you're our legal Siri? So how do you feel about the whole motion in general?
Well, if you break it down, so, right, one big question is, under what circumstances can the victim and or their family address their court? And the big circumstance where that right is present is when we have a parole hearing or a resentencing, which I think makes a lot of sense. If we're releasing someone early or we're changing their sentence, we have an identifiable victim who was harmed by this defendant, and they have a right to speak either in favor of or against the sentence being reduced or the person being granted early release.
Right.
Here, we have both the prosecutor and the defense agreeing this was a wrongful conviction, and the prosecutor saying we should null pros, meaning we should drop the charges and have essentially an exoneration. And so I think that's fundamentally different from we're agreeing this person is still guilty and the question is early release. And then we get to the question of notice and appearance. And I think this is kind of where the world has changed since COVID. And this was a big argument by Erica Souter in the defense, which is to say the family, specifically Hayes' brother, was able to attend and even address the court via Zoom, just not in person. And so that's the question, is how much notice to be able to quote unquote attend? Does that mean in person or is it teleconferencing? And so my personal position is, if they're able to attend and certainly address the court via Zoom, et cetera, that should suffice for an exoneration as opposed to, say, a resentencing or a early release, parole, et cetera.
That's one thing that blew my mind about it. Obviously, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know all the legal nuance to it. But I was watching live when all this was happening, and like I remember, like Rabia said, where their lawyer made the argument that he didn't have time to get there. The judge put us in recess while we waited for Young to get off of work, and then was able to zoom in. He was able to speak, and his words I thought were pretty powerful. He said he thought the prosecution was on his side. He didn't understand, but then he also said that paraphrasing, but kind of that he trusts that if they think they have the wrong guy, then they should let him out. Essentially, regardless of how much notice he had, he did attend virtually, which since 2020, I mean, that's half the hearings anyway, even when people are local. And was able to speak, and then they come back and make the argument that he didn't have enough notice. I don't even understand how that's even possible. And also, it's weird that
I really thought that the appeal I thought that it would be dismissed at the lower level appellate court. I was just shocked that they took it and it's gone all the way up. And even in Damien's case, I mean, even this ruling, Damien's ruling, it was 3-4. It's not like it was like. And I read some of the dissenting opinions, and I'm like, holy crap! I mean, it was so close.
They called him a depraved murderer in the dissent.
Yeah.
They said this is fruitless effort to exonerate a depraved murderer was written into the dissent order.
This is awful. And they argued like the finality shit. I mean, finality, three decades almost after like everything's changed in like forensic testing, and I mean, I don't know. I was just really sad. And I'm like, how old were these judges? I was saddened to read it.
So, Colin, what do you think when the decision comes down, either in favor of the state's motion or if it's denied and everything stands, what can we expect to see happen next in either circumstance?
Well, so first of all, the Supreme Court of Maryland could decide in Adnan's favor and find there was sufficient notice, this was a valid hearing, in which case the motion to vacate, meaning all the charges and convictions dismissed, is now valid. And then that nolle pros, which is the state's attorney saying, it's over, we're not going to prosecute this again. So he's free then permanently at that point. His exoneration is in place, his convictions are dropped. If the Supreme Court upholds the intermediate appellate court, presumably there'll be a new hearing on the motion to vacate and the nolle pros. Now, it was Marilyn Mosby who did the first one. Now, Ivan Bates is in place. Bates has been very supportive of Adnan in the past. No reason to think he wouldn't go forward with the motion to vacate. There would just be a new hearing with the family being given additional notice. And there's no reason to believe that anything would change. The Brady violation is still there, and there's still all the reasons to believe that on the merits, this motion to vacate and the nolle pros are valid.
That's what the interesting thing is, that when this first came out, the thought was, well, okay, fine, they'll just do a redo and they'll just redo the same thing all over again. But as you said, now there's a change in the guard; it's a different prosecutor. So you guys, and I know Robbie, you have a close understanding of what's going on in those offices, living up that way. Are you guys confident that Bates will redo the redo that we're talking about?
Well, my guess is that he will recuse himself from it because of his past, which, I mean, I think he'll do that just kind of as a political move, but it wouldn't be consistent with what he's done in the past. For example, and the reason he might recuse himself is because he was in the documentary. He's made public statements about supporting the case, all this stuff, right? However, he also, the minute he got into office, like dropped charges against Keith Davis Jr.
Right.
Who is a defendant that he actually worked on his case and wrote motions in his defense, like directly. So if there's ever, a time to recuse yourself, that might've been it. He didn't do it in that case.
Right.
And so if he recused himself, I would be slightly disappointed, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the motion wouldn't go forward. I don't know. I mean, I feel like the DA's office would have the option at that point to say, well, we're not even bringing the motion again. If, you know, that's why this is so stressful. It's like, you just don't know. And I feel like every time I've thought something's going to go a certain way, it never does. And, you know, Adnan is mentally preparing himself because he's like, look, if they uphold the lower court's decision and charges are reinstated, that could technically mean he could be reincarcerated. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. He's literally mentally preparing himself that if I have to go to prison, I will go to prison, and then we will keep working. We'll, you know, do a motion to resentence, or we'll try to, you know, and on the Brady thing, you know, the Attorney General's office also joined this whole melee, you know, to as a party opposing the state's attorney, which is also ridiculous. And then you had out of left field, the former prosecutor Urich raised his hand and was like, I got something to say. And then he submitted stuff saying that, you know, to try to prove that the Brady violation was not in fact a Brady violation, and lied basically. And we have evidence that he lied, but you know, if it gets relitigated, then we'll provide that. But it's just, there's so many dirty, entrenched people in this space right now. And I have a feeling like that Heyman Lee's family, what her brother said in court really truly reflected where they were. You know what I mean? Yeah. But they were just, because their attorney walked in with Thiru Vignaraja. I think they're just being manipulated by these prosecutors to keep going. And they're being told, you don't have to pay for anything. We'll cover the cost. You know, it'll be pro bono. And it's for victims' rights. And they're just being manipulated because of these absolute jerks.
Yeah, because the reality is, and the weirdness about this is, it's the state fighting the state.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the prosecutor, you know, the prosecuting or the state's attorney overturned the conviction. And then the attorney general's office is the one really behind who's fighting that ruling, which, because, you know, Mosby called out the attorney general's office for some of the Brady violations and some of the corruption that they had in the case. So they're fighting with each other. It feels like from the outside looking in that like the defense is kind of on the sidelines watching the state fight the state over this whole thing.
And it feels like anybody can walk in and become a party to this whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, which is also crazy to me.
Two questions about one. You mentioned that, you know, Urich weighed in and lied, and we have evidence to the contrary. I had seen or read, or maybe you told, I don't remember, but that's regarding the Brady violation about the witness saying that someone threatened to kill Hay. And he claimed that memo that he was writing about Adnan. And then I read somewhere that there's a witness that, like, you know who. We know who that was that actually said that, and they have come forward and sworn an affidavit. Has that been made public yet, or can it be? Do we know who that was, or is that something that has to wait to come out?
It has to wait to come out. I know all the answers to those questions, but I can't tell them.
Right. Is it fair to say that if that argument gets litigated?
Oh, yeah. Urich wants to go there. He's going to perjure himself.
Because the person who actually said it is
the source of the information.
Source of the information is like, that's not what I told him, which is exactly what he did with Asia McClain.
Right.
He has no scruples perjuring himself.
Yeah. And the other kind of ties in, because the people I'm about to talk to just kind of slandered Asia all over the place on their show. So the Prosecutors podcast did there. And I know, Colin, I don't know if you followed the whole thing, or at least you got into some Twitter tangles about all that. I don't want to, I just spent 5 months relitigating that on my show, so I didn't get into that. But one of the things they kept saying is that the way the conviction being overturned was done was illegitimate, that they didn't present evidence, that it was unprecedented the way that they went about overturning the conviction, essentially claiming corruption from the state's attorney's office. Do you feel there's any legitimacy to that, or do you think the procedural part of how this all came about was the way it should have been?
I mean, that's the thing for us. I would say a majority of our exonerations we've covered have been through conviction review units.
Yeah.
And a lot of my research, including an article I published in the George Washington Law Review, is all about the origin, the development of conviction review units. And that's what this was. It was initially presented to the Sentencing Integrity Unit of Baltimore County and then shifted over to the CRU there. But what was done there is fairly standard for what we see with CRUs.
That's what they do.
They investigated it for a year. They went through the files. They gathered evidence, including this memo by Yurick with the notes that was mentioned. They did a joint motion with the defense. They presented the evidence to the judge. There was a hearing. It's all standard. I mean, you look at our other cases where this has happened, it's the same thing. And none of those exonerations were called into question.
But I'm glad to hear it, because, you know, again, sometimes it's tricky. Right? I feel like I've been surrounded by the law for these last 9 years that I've been doing this. So I have a little bit of an understanding about it. But then I hear, you know, that these are professional prosecutors saying, oh, this is nonsense. It wasn't done right. And that's all. Didn't make any sense.
Have they heard of a conviction review unit or conviction integrity unit before? Did they even know what that is?
Yeah. If you go to the Quattrone Center, that is the center that does all, it's a clearinghouse of conviction review units, correct practices, incorrect practices, what you should do, what you shouldn't. And what was done in Adnan's case is textbook from the Quattrone Center of how you would do conviction review unit overturning a wrongful conviction.
Yeah. So, well, that's good to hear, because like they are. Those two are real good at like just sounding very convincing in everything they say. And as they, you know, and Robbie, you mentioned earlier about like sticking with this and the stress that's going into it and Adnan's possibility of coming back or, you know, having to go back to prison if this thing gets overturned. Like these are all real consequences. And that was, you know, the reason we did the reply brief was because all of a sudden here comes this propaganda machine to come out and put a bunch of negative sentiment out on the case with a bunch of, you know, misrepresentations, mischaracterizations, and lies about it.
I appreciate the fact that you took so much time and so much effort. I know how much it takes to actually respond to that, because like a lot of, I mean, like basically the last story that lingers is what stays in people's imaginations. And,
right.
It does have an impact. I would hope it doesn't have an impact in court, but it certainly has an impact in the public. I will say this, you know, Adnan is out and about, and I have witnessed many times when I've been with him, people recognizing him. He's never had a negative encounter. People are so warm and so kind and so happy for him. And everybody's always like impressed after they meet him because he's a very kind, impressive person. And I'm just happy that that's like what he's experienced since he's come out. Just a lot of love from people and support, and people so excited to see him around. And I hope it stays that way.
Yeah, me too. And I guess that's a good place for us to kind of wrap things up. Is can you tell us what Adnan's up to? You know, I know he's working with Georgetown University.
Prison Justice Initiative. He has a job. He bought a car. I mean, it's so cute. I went with him to the bank the other day and he's like showing me, you know, he's like, look, this is my social security card and this is my ID card. Like all these things.
Yeah.
When he got out, he didn't have any of it. Right. Like, and, we were opening a bank account for him and the woman was looking at him. She's like, you look familiar. And he's like, he just started telling his story. He's like, when I was 17, I was incarcerated for a crime. I didn't commit. It was just like the whole thing unfolding in front of him. And you know, she's just like, she fell in love with him in those 15, 20 minutes. Like he's just a really sweet boy. And it's just his, just watching him just be excited for things that he's always, there's so many firsts, you know, for people in this, who have not experienced the world in decades. So he's doing well. His parents are elderly. And so he's taking care of them. They're not doing too well. His dad's like not well, but, his mom's actually doing much better. And he's like been helping renovate their house and he's doing good generally. Awesome. You know, I spent my second Ramadan, you know, with him, not with him. I saw him like 3 or 4 times in Ramadan, but it's been amazing.
It is. All those firsts are cool. I remember when Ed got out, I got to experience that. You know, I spent the first week with him when he got out of prison after 20 years.
Yeah.
And I tell the story all the time, but I remember he and I went to Walmart. We went and bought a grill and he wanted to smoke some ribs. And we're just like walking through Walmart. And I remember he just grabbed me by the shoulder. Bah, look at all this stuff. And you could just, you can just, all you need is money and you can just have all this stuff. And it was like, and
it's amazing.
Him
yeah.
experiencing the self-checkout was priceless. You know, when he walked up, he's like, what? What is this?
Nobody. Yeah, we could just walk out with all this stuff.
He was like, it was like my kid with me, you know, he was like, wait, I gotta do it. And then it was like, let me scan it. Let me, you know, it was just everything's so new yeah. when you've been locked up for that long.
Well, you know, the day that Damien's ruling just came out, Anand had stopped by for lunch. And that's when we went to the bank too. And he's like, did you know? And I'm like, what? He's the one who told me. So that was really
about Damien's ruling.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause he stays on top of this kind of news. So he was very happy.
That's awesome. All right. Last question before we wrap it up comes from the chat. Caroline Dwyer wants to know, Rabia, what is your deadlift personal best these days?
You know what? I don't deadlift. I don't deadlift. I don't know. I think because I'm usually working out alone and I'm always like worried about like, I feel like deadlifting, don't you need a spotter or something? I don't deadlift. I use smaller weights and stuff. I mean, not small weights, but you know, I mean like barbells and dumbbells and kettlebells and things like that. I don't really deadlift.
No. Well, there's your answer, yeah. Caroline. You got the last question.
I should though.
The answer is she doesn't. All right. And with that, I'm going to let you guys both go. I am so excited for Undisclosed to come back. When you told me that, Robbie, I just immediately, that was really my entrance into true crime, even as a consumer, was you guys and Susan at the beginning. You know, I listened to Serial on accident. I didn't know it was about some comedy show I listened to, kept referencing it. So I listened to it having no clue what I was listening to. And, you know, it was a neat story. And then when I started listening to Undisclosed, I'm like, oh, there's people out there that are actually like working and investigating.
Serious about it.
Yeah. Yeah. Like that's what got me hooked. And it's just kind of those feels all over again. So I cannot wait for it to come back. And thank
you. Well, I can't wait for your season on the case that I handed over to you. And I'm so grateful. I can't tell you how grateful I am that you're working on it.
Oh, I'm ready to rock and roll on it too. I'm actually hiring one of my students that's about to graduate as an intern to help research and write. She's super talented. You know, it's the best interview process ever. Over the last year, I've got to see every script she's written and their research skills and all that. And I'm like, hey, when you graduate, her folks are coming over to check out the studio this weekend so we can prepare for them to come in. And she's going to come on board and help write that season.
When is that season going to air, do you think?
Good question. I'm thinking beginning of June. I'm fighting for documents. The trial transcripts. We got those all digitized. I got the stuff that you sent me. I've got some stuff from some of the other advocates. And then I went to the police agency to get the case file and crime scene documents and everything. And they claimed they shredded them and don't have them. And then they have not.
They're in a warehouse somewhere. They're like in some way, you know, they always are.
Yeah. And so then I told them in the emails back and forth, they're like, so I don't know, you know, is some a former chief did this. They shredded them. And I was like, well, good news. You should have given an entire copy of that to the prosecutor's office. So get it from them and nothing. So then I went to the prosecutor's office and filed for it. And they told me they have the case file, but they have no evidence. They have no recordings, no transcripts of interviews, none of the police file. They claim they don't have like all the exhibits at trial. And one of you two, or Colin, especially, you should know the answer to this. I've never experienced this where they're claiming that the court did not save copies of the trial exhibits.
I mean, I've never heard of that.
Right.
That doesn't add up.
I had this conversation.
And I might say they disposed of it at a certain point, but if they're just saying we never actually retained it right after the trial, that would be highly irregular.
Right. Well, that's what I said to them. And I'm dealing with the FOIA person who then has, you know, because I've asked to talk to the actual prosecutor and haven't made that connection yet. But I said, well, ask them this. If you're claiming that nowhere exists, when I'm reading the trial transcript and it says, here, we're presenting this, we're marking this, Exhibit 10. Where's Exhibit 10? I need to see what Exhibit 10 is.
Yeah.
And you're claiming you don't have any of that. And she's, that's what they say. It was all sent back to the police agency. And like, there's no, they would not have kept copies. You have to have copies. And I said, ask, and I'm waiting for the response to this. I said, I want you to ask the prosecutor this. because I've already been investigating and I already have evidence. Robbie's aware of, I think I sent it to you. I already have some evidence that very well in and of itself could result in the conviction being overturned and a new trial being ordered. So ask the prosecutor what they're going to do then. If you're telling me you have zero evidence for this case, if the conviction is overturned, what next? So I'm waiting to hear from them. So that's been the delay as I wanted to get the full case file.
Also, shouldn't they have been in the defense files as well?
Well, that's kind of what we have, but it's been scattered all over the place. And what I'm looking for, what I'm really looking for in there is, I want all the trial exhibits and I want the recordings. There was, there's recordings of all these interviews, the 911. And as you know, in this case, Rabia, like the 911 call, that recording, that's important.
It's so important.
Very important to this case. Yeah. And nobody seems to know where it is. So that's been the fight. That's been the delay I'm trying to get as much information as we can to before we launch into it and get started.
All right. Well, I'm excited. And I know I'm not going to say the name, but I know they are excited as well.
And so with that, that's what we have coming up. And very soon in the next year, Undisclosed, the reboot is coming. Rabia, Colin, thank you both so much for joining me and good luck with the relaunch.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks. Same to you.
Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production. All music for the show is created and composed by Shane Yoder at PutThemInASong.com. The font you see on all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com manages, and maintains our website, Truth and Justice Pod, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Erica Cantor, Melissa Cardenas, Kay Woodyomnik, and Danielle Rohr. And as always, thank you to all of you for your engagement and your support. If you like the show and you want to support us, you can do that in a number of ways. The number one way for you to support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. If you join our Patreon, not only will you be financially supporting our work, but you'll also get something for your pledge. For just $5 per month, you'll get all episodes ad-free and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups that include an hour-long pre-show chat exclusive to our patrons. Other levels will get you a Truth and Justice Army t-shirt, Truth and Justice hats, and even the opportunity to co-host a Friday follow-up episode. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and it goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a case that you'd like us to consider covering, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page, follow us on Instagram, or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. For all of you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter @TruthJusticePod, and I can be found on social media @BobRuffTruth. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch, but as for now, I'm signing off. I'm Bob Ruff, and this has been Truth and Justice.